For over 4 years, I too walked through the conference rooms and visiting rooms and hallways of a mental institution. I did so, however, not as a family member, but as a chaplain. In the late 2000s, I was hired to be the director of pastoral care for New Hampshire Hospital, New Hampshire's only state psychiatric hospital. What I learned there will travel with me for the rest of my life. I learned about the devastation that can happen to individuals and to families in the wake of severe mental illness. I learned about the gifts and the limits of psychiatric medication. I also learned about the potential fragility of the human mind and the potential resilience of the human spirit. I also learned about the inadequacy of our current mental health system to meet the needs of those suffering. There are many changes that need to be made to bring more justice and care to those with severe mental illness. While the numbers of those who need care grow, and the number of beds and psychiatrists reserved to meet that need continues to fall. So the numbers get higher, and the beds, year by year, get fewer. But while the system needs to be changed, our minds and hearts need to be changed as well. I wholeheartedly agree with Elizabeth O'Connor when she says, "Of one thing I am certain, nothing will change for the homeless unless the public is given a new heart. The task before us is no lesser one than the education of our emotions." And so for the next few minutes, rather than cite more research and statistics, I want to share some very brief stories with you about the education of my emotions and the many lessons I learned from the patients who were my teachers. I have learned not to judge a person by how they look or even behave. How little we can know about anyone we see on the street mumbling nonsense, or one who sticks their hand out for money. For me, and I suspect for most of us, the very poor and desperate make us anxious and uncomfortable. While we may see ourselves as compassionate people, it is just so much easier to look away and walk on by. Not only Thomas flees from such a need. Not so, however, for my 6-year-old daughter, Allie, now about to turn 30, by the way. We were walking out of Ocean State Job Lot in Walpole, New Hampshire, a very sort of upper crust and quiet town, not the place where you're expected to meet a homeless person. But standing right outside the door was a gaunt man in dirty clothes, missing a few teeth. And my daughter immediately said, "Hello," and started moving towards him. "My name is Allison." I'm embarrassed to say that my first reaction was fear. And anxiously, I called out, "Allie, come over here, Allie." And she looked at me and said, "Mommy, I'm talking to this man." At which point he asked her name. She asked his name and he told her. And he said, "Allie, you are such a nice little girl. I hope you have a very nice day." It was the smile on his face, however, that nearly brought me to tears. So Allie went up in her way and gave him the very slightest of a little hug and walked back to me as we walked to the grocery store and said, "Mommy, I like that man." Years later, I got a look of what could be on the inside of someone who looked so dirty and unkempt on the outside. The woman who arrived at New Hampshire Hospital passed me by while I was sitting in the cafeteria. She was remarkably dirty with tangled hair, shocking in appearance, really, gaunt and terrified looking, barely looking like a human being. Because she was on a unit that I did not cover, I did not get to learn her story until 3 weeks later. I was again in the hall, and I saw a very attractive woman, nicely dressed, talking on the phone in the entryway, and I turned to my colleague and said, "Do you have any idea who that is?" And she goes, "Oh, yes. She's that woman who used to live in the barn, who came in about 3 weeks ago." She was an LPN, the mother of three, who had simply disappeared. And for 2 years, she lived in the streets and haunted the farms in the Monadnock region, not knowing who she was, trying to survive just one more day, given the right medication, some respect, and a bed to sleep in and food to eat, she was miraculously transformed. The phone call was her talking to a nursing home where she was applying for a job as an LPN. Her family picked her up that afternoon. I've also learned how easily fear can shut down our hearts, how it gets in the way of genuine human connection, how that fear can dehumanize others and teach them to never reach out, to keep other people away. There was a patient when I first got to the hospital, I'll call him Bob, and he did not have a traditional organically based mental illness or PTSD. He had actually had a construction injury that had bashed in part of his skull, and he had lost control of his emotions, could become violent at the drop of a hat. But luckily, as his brain healed, and as he got a lot of support and therapy, he was able to slowly come back into himself. And by the time I knew him, he'd been there about a month, it was hard to understand why he was even in a locked psychiatric unit. And so he got ready to go out and start his life again. To my surprise, on the last day, I took him to lunch. We got to do that then. And he said to me, "There's only one favor I need from you, patients. I want you to go to Big John." I knew who Big John was. "And I want you to give him a hug for me." And I said, "Oh, you mean the scary 6'8" Big John?" Who'd been in the hospital for at least a year, if not two. And he said, "Yes." He said, "He's not really scary. He's just afraid of everyone. He helped me more than anyone else in this hospital. And he doesn't like people to talk about feelings, and he doesn't like to be touched, but I think you're just the one to deliver that hug." People know me really quickly. We won't talk about how the administration felt about hugs. We're just skipping that part. So I did. I went up to the long-term chronic unit, and I spoke to him, and I said, "Bob is leaving, and he has asked me to do him a favor, so I'm about to hug you." And I could feel him just go completely rigid. And when the nurses weren't looking, I crept up and gave him the world's shortest hug. From that day, I knew a very different man than many of the people, including the staff, who were afraid of him. Every now and again, he'd come to my office on the administration wing when he had privileges and said, "I'm not here to talk, I just need that hug." I learned also the power of compassion to heal, when even the finest doctors and advanced medications cannot. There was a woman on that same long-term unit who wouldn't eat. She refused to eat and slowly would wither away until they would get permission from the court to put a feeding tube down her throat and feed her against her will. I will admit I never really talked to her. I went in once to her room when she was in bed and getting in and getting some kind of intravenous feeding, and she said, "Get out of here," and I got out of there. I didn't know much about her story, but I did come to learn that she had been a drug addict on the street, and she had had children who had been taken away from her. And she, now she was better and sober, had decided that she had committed an unforgivable sin and that she wanted to die, and the only means she could find was to stop eating. And then something happened. There was a woman who lived with her, a woman whom I got quite close with, who had also spent some time on the street and also had been an addict, but also had schizophrenia, and which I suspect was more a cover for severe PTSD. And she got into trouble one day and was told she had to stay in her room, and so she called me. And I came up to see her, and I said, "What did you do this time?" And she said, "Oh, you know, I mouthed off to one of the therapists. It's not a big deal. I can do 3 days in the room." But she said, "I'm worried about Ruth." And I said, "Yeah?" And she said, "Well, have you noticed that she's looking better?" And I said, "Yeah, I really had. I can't figure, what, did they change her medication?" And she goes, no. She said she started eating because she loves candy and we're not allowed to have it. So I sneak it into my pockets when I'm on privileges. And I sneak it under her socks in her drawer so no one will know. And then she gets up when no one's looking and eats. She wanted me to smuggle candy into the unit, which I felt was maybe a step too far. But I certainly applauded her civil disobedience. I'm going to fast forward now to after I'd left the hospital. And I went to visit Glencliff, which is a nursing home for the mentally ill, a wonderful place, a place of healing, by the way, quite remarkable. And I still go to see a couple patients there now and again. And I was in the dining room, and there was this lovely, long-haired, plump woman sitting and chatting with this man. And she said, patients, come over. What are you doing here?" It was Ruth. Ruth was eating mashed potatoes and had a boyfriend. And I was flabbergasted. And I said, "Whatever happened to your friend from the hospital?" And they had made a pact that they wouldn't go to Glencliff without each other. And she said, "Oh, she only lived about another 6 or 7 months. She did have cancer and kidney disease. And but she came here and was much happier before she died." And she said, "And you know, she's the one who saved my life." I shared stories of those who were in the hospital for long periods of time, long enough to be part of a community, because it was helping to deepen and create that interconnection and community that I felt was my most important job as chaplain. Communities can be a place of healing. Nursing homes can be, hospitals can be, even rooming houses. But what about communities such as yours? What about Unitarian Universalist faith communities? I have a dream for our UU congregations to be one of those few safe places for those struggling with mental illness. This priceless offer of community to those often stigmatized and excluded requires intentionality and a willingness to strengthen boundaries while deepening welcome and support. It takes both courage and compassion. It takes an awareness of one's own need and self-care. And as so many things of real value, it takes a willingness to risk. want to close with a story that came out of my more recent ministry. There was a man in my congregation, a leader of the congregation in many ways, who struggled throughout his life with severe depression. He had come to me to share that he was feeling suicidal and was able to find the strength and enough hope to call the hospital and get himself hospitalized. This happened 2 or 3 times. He was a quiet man, an engineer, with that sort of way that some engineers have of not spilling out what they're feeling very often. He was our Mr. Fix-It man for the heating and the roof problems and all of that. But I knew that every day was a struggle for him to survive. After his second hospitalization, when he began to get a little better, he came to my office and said, "Patients, I'm thinking of sharing at Joys and Concerns the fact that I've been suicidal and that I've twice been in the hospital in the last 3 months. What do you think?" It was a hard question. I basically said, "Oops, I can't make that decision for you. But here's what I will tell you. It is my trust and belief that if you choose to share something, that the response will be positive, will be toward you, not away from you." But I said, there are no guarantees. People are very scared about depression and suicide for good reasons. Well, I wasn't in that. It was interesting. I wasn't there that week. It was another person in the pulpit, a guest minister like myself is for you. And after it was over, after I came back to work, the first thing I wanted to do was call this gentleman on the phone and say, "How did it go?" Because I hadn't heard anything yet. So he came in, he did stop by, and he says, "I did tell them. I told them how hard it had been. I told him that I had been barely able to keep myself from suicide or self-harm. And I wanted them to know." And I said, "Okay, what happened?" And he said, "By the end of coffee hour, I had 3 dates for coffee." But he also said, the only other person who knows this besides my family is this older woman in my congregation, my former congregation, who had been struggling with depression since the age of 22. She'd been in and out of hospitals 20 or more times. And she was at a place where she liked herself for a while. And he had confided in her, and they had been meeting for coffee every week for a month and a half. He said she was one of those strings that helped to hold me together. In summary, one P.S., and I'm gone too long, so you'll have to forgive me. I'm only here once a year. It's really hard to stop. There's a second part of the story. I did a group for the congregation. We had a lot of depression in that congregation, a lot of people struggling with depression, so I did a group on self-compassion based on a book I'm going to recommend later to Barnaby, and not for his depression, but for to share with the congregation. And I led that group for 4 weeks. They decided to keep meeting, but I was about to leave, and I couldn't make that long-term commitment. And so now he and another member of the congregation are leading that group. And the last I heard, it's 2.5 years, and they still meet to practice meditation, to talk about self-care, and to help one another heal. In summary, it's important to advocate for more psychiatric beds. Please do whenever you can. Better and often longer-term treatment for those with severe mental illness. I have brought a couple of flyers, which I'm going to send to Laura later. In case any of you want them, there's going to be a little sign-up sheet. They're very simple, but they have some very good information in them. But you know, that's not enough. Each of us needs to be aware of all we don't know about that person sitting next to us or across from us or on the street beside us. Each of us needs to work together to create space where hurting and lonely people are welcome, truly welcome, and where our deepest stories can be safely shared. A sacred place where we are encouraged to remember that the holy dwells in each and every one of us, even you, at your very lowest. It is my belief that this is becoming such a community. And let me tell you from personal experience, it is absolutely worth the risk. We'll close with hymn 121, We'll Build a Land.